This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Hello and welcome along. Today, the conflict in the Middle East and the subsequent disruption to the fuel supply chain has the Australian resources sector having a really good look around at a range of energy alternatives for the future. So we'll have a look at some of those options they're looking at with some of the movers and shakers at Diggers and Dealers, the mining forum that's been underway in Kalgoorlie-Boulder this week. And also, Australian Eggs, that's the national representative body, says that vaccines could be a useful option to help commercial chicken and egg producers combat the H5 bird flu. It is 12:06 here on the ABC WA. The CEO of WA Farmers says Australia should be working towards establishing a National Food Integrity and Fraud Investigation Agency. This follows the ABC Four Corners investigation, Duped, Food Exposed, which looked at a range of food from cage-free eggs and Australian seafood to tomato products, spices and alcohol. It uncovered products whose labels did not match independent scientific testing, raising questions about the integrity of Australia's food supply. Trevor Whittington, how many of the items featured on the show did you find in your pantry?
Well, they're not in the pantry anymore. They're in the sort of rubbish bin. But look, there was at least a dozen. Maybe it doesn't help. Married to an Italian background wife, and there's lots of tomatoes, pastes and sauces and extra virgin olive oil, other bits and pieces that, and a bit of a foodie myself, so spices and herbs. And, yeah, I recognise far too many of those brands that all came out of Coles or Woolworths where we bought them from. And they did not, they came up with, from the scientific testing, with some nasties in them that you wouldn't be wanting to feed your kids or eat yourself.
So a little bit of the trust has gone from what you're reading on those labels.
Well, it's the trust in our system because these, we bought them obviously from a major retailer. They are Australian importers, wholesalers, or worse, they're Australian manufacturers of food. And most people don't know it, but food and beverage is our biggest manufacturing industry. You know, it's 20,000 businesses involved in it right across Australia. It's massive. And we just all automatically assumed it's regulated within an inch of its life because it's all about food safety. We keep hearing about we're a clean, green producer of food. So whatever we end up in the supermarket must be as good as, you know, the farmers produce it. And that was a bit of a wake-up call because it doesn't seem to be the case.
So at what point in the supply chain do you think the system's being let down?
Importers and manufacturers. Now, it's not big in WA because most of the imports come from over east, and the people making the Mars bars and the Weet-Bix and the packaging up the herbs and spices and rebranding the oils and the syrups and the honeys and all the rest of it. It's mostly eastern states. And of course, WA Farmers, our members, we actually produce a bulk commodity, livestock, walk them onto a grate, into a truck, grain, drop it into a grate, goes through a CBH system, whatever. And we're not actually in the manufacturing game. CBH is a little bit with its Blue Lake oats, but the real manufacturing that takes the stuff that's processed, and you should all, all the listeners should only be buying stuff that's not coming wrapped up with a barcode on it and a can, but too many of the people in the community does. They're buying cans and frozen food and processed foods. So that's all been manufactured. And it's just too easy to add imported spices out of Southeast Asia or Africa, cheap labour, poor regulations, blend it in and then put on the labelling, made in Australia, Australian food. And that does not look like the case from what was a quite intensive investigation by the ABC.
And so farmers are holding up their end of the stick, though.
Look, we're regulated with an infinite life. There is always yet another round of compliance systems that our Minister for Agriculture, who also happens to be the Minister for Food, likes to trot out, whether it's electronic ear tags or we've got vets in the abattoir overseen by the Department of Agriculture. But Jackie Jarvis is also the Minister for Food. So what compliance, and there's a whole bunch of food regulations, the Health Department, Department of Agriculture, Biosecurity, all the rest of it, that she's responsible for. There's also a lot the federal minister is responsible for. But what compliance regulation is going on in these factories or the importers and the ports to make sure they're not blending it in from stuff that's not up to Australian standards? And having gone through the DPIRD's department's annual report, looked at the minister's budget, looked at their press releases from this Labor government last 10 years, I can't see there's a section in there of people going out and inspecting these facilities to make sure the food we're eating and where our reputation as farmers is hanging off is, you know, the clean, green, safe that we all think it is supposed to be.
So what needs to happen?
Well, if you look around the world, UK, Denmark, Denmark's the gold standard of having a food compliance unit. So think of it like the old stock squad. We used to have in the Department of Ag, these stock specialists go out there and make sure that people are doing the right thing with their stock. So they were specialists. We've lost that, unfortunately. Denmark has a massive food industry, one of the biggest in the world, a lot of processing. So they actually have specialist science, food scientists, accountants and, you know, investigators. And they go out and they go into the factories and the processing facilities and the importers and they check. Use all the DNA and all the specialist checking stuff and it's a track and trace. And they don't wait for complaints because who's going to complain because who's going to know? And they've got a full testing compliance arrangement, and it's no doubt expensive, to guarantee that when it says made in Denmark or processed in Denmark or whatever, it is for real. UK's got a good system because they got a lot of horse meat blended into beef as a result of the, you know, the foot and mouth scare and the price of beef over there. They've got quite a good system. We've got nothing. Nothing like that. We've got legislation. We've got all the powers, but the minister does not, you know, direct her department to set up a proactive investigation. And we will wear the penalty because we run around Asia. The minister runs around Asia. The rest of us, we also come and buy our wheat and our grain and our, you know, fruit and all the rest of it, which is great. But our reputation is based on how safe our stuff's here. And we all know what happened in China with blending of powdered milk and all the rest of it up there. If you can't trust your own food produced that you can buy in retail here, how the hell can we sell it overseas?
So really the country needs to look at some sort of food integrity or fraud investigation agency.
Yeah, exactly. The federal government set up Fair Work and they pour vast amounts of money in to make sure that you, the farmer, the small business person, pays your super on time or now, you know, within 7 days. And they'll come down on you like a ton of bricks. They have a full compliance system in there, track and trace, and investigators, as they do with tax. They love the tax money. They'll chase it to the last dollar. You know, we do it with trucking and transport where we've got the heavies out there. There's a whole range of government investigations, compliance people. We do it in the health and the hospitals. Health department goes in there and does compliance audits. And we're not seeing that in our biggest manufacturing sector, which is our most critical, that, you know, underpins our $100 billion farming sector with our exports. And it's not a big deal. How you'd fund it, you'd probably put, and I hate it, yet another levy, but a levy on the imports, because that's where the problem is of the, you know, $25 billion worth of food is being imported. We produce $100 billion, but still importing far too much, as far as I'm concerned. It doesn't matter. So that would raise $250 million around and you'd spread it around Australia and you would just make sure these manufacturers and the retailers and anyone who's saying they're organic or that it's made in Australia or that hasn't been blended with something that's cheap and nasty. Not hard to sit there and see a bulk container of, I don't know, herbs coming in from Sri Lanka and just do a sample test. But that costs money, and I think that would be money well spent. And in fact, I think we're setting ourselves up for a problem if we don't do it.
Trevor, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks, Belinda.
Trevor Whittington, he is the CEO of Lobby Group WA Farmers, pretty concerned with what he saw in the ABC Four Corners investigation, duped, food exposed, and thinks it would be a good idea if Australia started working towards establishing a national food integrity and fraud investigation agency. If you missed the show, you can have a look back at it. It's a two-part series. Just search ABC Four Corners and it'll be clear which episodes you want to have a look at. 12:15.
On ABC Radio WA, you're with Belinda Barischetti for the WA Country Hour.
Great to have you along this afternoon. The conflict in the Middle East and the subsequent disruption to the fuel supply chain has the Australian resources sector examining a range of energy alternatives for the future. It's been a big talking point at this year's Diggers and Dealers Mining Forum in Kalgoorlie-Boulder. Marnie Finlayson from uranium company DevEx was one of the movers and shakers at this year's forum and says energy security is front of mind.
Oh, definitely. Coming out of the last real energy crisis, which was in the 1970s, the year coming out of that, at the end of the crisis, the price of uranium went up 400%. So that real pivot to say, we need energy security, where do we get it from? Okay, this is why we need to make sure we're not so reliant. And you can move yellow cake around very easily and, yeah, not so much oil in tankers, as we know.
Warren Pearce, Chief Executive Officer of the Association of Mining and Exploration Companies. Yes and no is the answer. So I think it certainly puts a big red flag over the vulnerability that exists. There's a lot of people in our industry, myself included, who'd counted on just-in-time delivery. And, you know, even when the refineries closed here in Western Australia and Kwinana 5 years ago, I remember ringing members and saying, look, this sounds like it might be a problem. This is a problem. They said, oh, no, it'll be okay. We'll just continue to import it. All it arrives as long as there's a, you know, a functioning supply chain. And that's worked flawlessly, right up until the point it doesn't. And the conflict in the Middle East and the closure of the Strait of Hormuz has made that vulnerability very real. So that means people are thinking more carefully. At the moment, the first thing we're thinking about is greater storage capacity, making sure we've got fuel supply in the event of disruptions. But certainly, it does energise the effort to think about how we bring in other technologies, other renewables to support our operations, and what we can move on to other power sources becomes much more critical. We've still obviously got the challenges with mobile fleet, but you've got companies like Fortescue working on issues like that, trying to bring in battery technology. So that journey's well and truly begun. But I think, if nothing else, the vulnerabilities in the global supply chain that we've seen the last 4 or 5 years, fuel supply, Middle East, COVID, all tell a pretty strong story, which is start thinking about what your other options are. You don't want to be reliant on these things, because when those things happen, we're a long way at the end of the world, at the end of the supply chain. It's going to be very difficult to cope without fuel.
My name's Tim Topham and I'm Managing Director of Top Drill. Majority of our fuel is supplied by our clients, but we've put a lot of effort into efficiency and trying to get optimisation, and we've seen some really good improvements coming out of that. But we do burn 100,000 litres of diesel a day, so it is of significant impact on the business for this volatility.
AJ Severimuto, Managing Director, Wildcat Resources. So we're a lithium company. We're looking at electric trucks, loaders, electric equipment, but certainly diesel is a key part of it, but we're pretty close to port. We're only 80 kilometres from port, so it keeps us in the lowest quartile. If your transport costs are close to port, then you don't have to move as much.
Hi, Matt Ducey here. I'm CEO of Boss Energy.
The volatility we saw in fuel prices earlier this year, was it the impetus or the impetus that was needed to look at alternative energy sources for the mining industry?
No, because it was in play before this fuel shortage and fuel price. I think this whole energy transition has been in play for a long time now, and what we're still seeing is just being accelerated.
Matt Ducey from Boss Energy talking about alternative fuel for the mining industry. And he and the others at the Diggers and Dealers Mining Forum were speaking to award winner Tara de Landgraaf. Yes, congratulations to Tara. I think she's been covering Diggers and Dealers for, what, 20 years now? This year, she was awarded the Media Prize, and I think she's going to retire because part of that prize she got an ounce of gold. There's no way Tara will retire. She'll be back at Diggers and Dealers, definitely, in 2027. 20 past 12, and we'll get an update from the newsroom shortly, and then it's off to the Weather Bureau. Take a look around. There's a little bit of rain on the way for parts of the Southwest Land Division. We'll get all the details shortly. Speaking of the weather, the season is shaping up very nicely for some station owners in the Midwest of the state. Jorgen Jensen is from Yowagabi Station near Mount Magnet, 560 kilometres northeast of Perth, and he got 21 millimetres of rain from a system that came through earlier this week. He says this winter reminds him of some of the better seasons from the 1990s.
We had a reasonable early start with the cyclone that came through, Burrell. We had 72 mil from that. Then we had a little while without any rain. Then we got a good soaking 40 mil overnight, rained all night. And we've had bits and pieces sort of either side of all that. We had 22 mil 3 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago. And we just had another 21 mil 2 days ago. So as far as winters goes, it's starting to look like some of the better ones you remember from the 90s. Flowers are already up, they'll go better now, but there's feed in a lot of areas where we don't often see it.
It's just that consistent rain topping everything up, and now you've had, I think you said 20 mil overnight, and there's the water's just sitting everywhere. You look around and there's puddles everywhere.
Yep, and it's still only start of August, so when the warm weather kicks in, the expectation would be a fairly good abundance of feed.
And looking around, everything looks like it has regenerated really well, and you're not carrying that many cattle. So do you, the feed you've got, do you think that'll carry you through summer? Like, how much have you sort of got in the bank now?
Yeah, the way it's looking now, I'm not concerned right through till, well, after this last rain, really right through till February, and that's without storms. We'll have enough dry feed well into February, even early March, possibly.
Jorgen Jensen from Yowagabi Station near Mount Magnet speaking to Joe Prendergast. 22 past 12. Well, not everyone in the region was as lucky as Jorgen this week. Rob Lefroy is from Nowra Station and he only got 1.5 mils of rain this week.
It unfortunately went through in a strip to the north of us and stayed on that line. But, yeah, we only got 1.5 mils. Wagano, which is 26 k's on the way to Yarragabby to your north, they got 15.5, and I think Yarragabby had 22 or something like that. So definitely heavier that way. Winds are out further out east of Mount Magnet. I think they finished up with 35 mils.
And we're about 60 k's south of Mount Magnet now?
Here to the homestead by road, it's near enough to 80.
So system's coming through, but pretty patchy by the sound of it.
Yeah, definitely patchy. Earlier on in the tail end of the cyclones, it was the other way around. They passed to the west of us in the line, or the majority of rain. I'm not saying we didn't get any, but there was an instance there, the tail end of a cyclone going through, and Golden Grove and Yalgoo had 80 and 90 mils. We had 18 or 19. Mm.
Now, listening to this conversation, I don't want people to think that it's not green here, because despite these stories, it's looking pretty good.
Definitely a lot better than it has been, Joe. I don't mind admitting we've only had 113 mils for the year, but it's fallen at the right time and come in intervals to make it look like it's looking now. You know, like last year wasn't too bad. I think we finished up with 136 mils for the year. And yes, we've still got a bit to go, but it's definitely, this season's better than what it has been in the last two or three anyway.
Coming out from Geraldton, there is flowers everywhere around Yalgoo. Not so many here, but I noticed what I call crowfoot. I don't know what you call it. Some of the plants in the paddock, they've all got these beautiful purple flowers on them, looking pretty good.
The everlastings, of course, were first to pop out this way, and I think everywhere. And Murchison and Yalgoo, they got earlier rain than what we did, and their flowers have been out for some time. But in talking of flowers, there are still plants or bushes of flowers that are still budded. They haven't opened up yet.
So they're yet to come.
They're yet to come. So I get phone calls from tourists just about two or three times every week about when are the flowers going. And I said, well, there's some out now, the early ones, the everlasting and what have you, they're always first out. But I just feel, you know, give it another month and what's going to come will be in full bloom here.
And everything just looks fresh and lush, which is really nice to see. You've not long transitioned to cattle here. How are they going? How are they looking?
Yeah, they've done well, really. Mind you, they're only a small lot compared to what the place can carry, but it's only on a trial, and so far so good. And if I go back 8 years ago, I think the first 2 years I was here at Nalbra, we didn't even make 50 mils of rain, and it was shocking, you know. And if we get a season or two like that, well, yes, cattle are going to battle. There's no doubt about that. Fortunately, we're in a position here where I'm not going to say we can do it straight away, but year by year you can put another paddock in as far as cattle fencing, and you have got dry feed, which paddocks that haven't been used, you know, for the period of time I've been here.
So that's what that rain is doing, is building up those plants that will eventually become your dried feed.
That's right, yeah. Mind you, wildflowers are great and it freshens the country up and looks great, but just depending how quickly it gets hot, like in the summer, is how long they'll last. Like they're only a herbage and they die off pretty quick once it starts to warm up. But if stock do get those plants sooner after all while they're drying up, they are still providing a good feed.
So happy cattle, happy Rob,
yeah,
lots of flowers. You also run a tourism business here at Nalbra. How has that been for visitor numbers given the price of fuel that we've seen over the past few months?
We open up each year at Easter time, but last Easter and May, it was hardly worth having the place open. It was one, if not two, caravans a week. And that, of course, was because of the fuel prices.
So that's what people were saying to you, they just weren't coming out.
Well, mind you, at Easter, we had 10 rooms booked here prior to Easter, and their intention was coming. But when that fuel went up right at that time, they rang up and cancelled and said they wouldn't be making the trip. So definitely made the difference, there's no doubt about that. But by the same token, since I realise fuel's gone up again now, but as far as tourism goes, it has picked up in the last couple of months and on par with what we've had the last couple of years. And with the phone calls I've had about wildflowers, well, I think, you know, towards the end of this month and early September, they'll sort of come as usual sort of thing.
You'll just be really keeping an eye on that price of fuel, that it doesn't get to $3 again.
That's right, yeah, and deterring everybody. Like, at Easter, Mount Magnet have their Gymkhana each year, and, you know, for a float and a four-wheel drive to drive out, even from Geraldton or wherever, it was a tank of fuel each way, and it sort of came to $500-$600 for them to just make the effort to get here, let alone doing it, spend any money anywhere else. So we were very lucky that with the attendance we did get, there's no doubt about that, and which really grateful for, but it could have been a disaster, there's no, with the fuel, going back to the fuel prices.
It flows through though, doesn't it? I mean, if people cancel their plans to come here, that's a room that you're not paid for. But then it's the butcher and the shop in town also not visiting.
Yeah, well, now you mentioned the butcher to Kenton. Everyone goes to Kenton, Mount Magnet, of course, because his meat's really good. And, you know, I've popped in there when I've gone into town and had a yarn to him, and he was shaking his head the same thing. There weren't any tourists around and what the place is going to come to, but yeah, recently I have seen him and he says it's definitely picked up. But you're dead right. If they're here for 3 or 4 days, well, they have an outing in Mount Magnet. And there's only one thing I'll say while we're on that subject, that Mount Magnet really lacks in a cafeteria. I believe there's a small cafe open by the hardware centre now, and they're doing coffees and, I don't know about meals, but snacks. And but tourists, of course, want to get to a place where they can sit down at the table and, you know, rather than a roadhouse sort of thing, and have a yak and meet up with their friends and what have you.
Sounds like a business opportunity for you, Rob. You better get the coffee caravan on the go.
Well, I don't know how I'd go there, but might be able to give them a kangaroo toast stew. That's about all.
Good to talk to you.
No worries.
I think Rob's onto something there. Wouldn't that be perfect? You know, ordering your oat latte, your iced strawberry matcha, and a side of kangaroo tail stew. Perfect. Rob Lefroy from Nowra Station, 80 kilometres south of Mount Magnet in the state's Midwest. He was speaking to Joe Prendergast. It is 12:30 here on the Country Hour. Ali Colvin in the studio with the headlines.
Thanks, Belinda. WA's Environment Minister says with the transmission of bird flu to the state's native wildlife inevitable, the government's seeking expert advice on how to best manage the virus. While WA hasn't seen a positive bird flu case in more than 2 weeks, South Australia recorded the country's first mass death last week. Matthew Swinburne says the new Bird Flu Wildlife Advisory Group will guide the state government's approach to the virus. A man convicted of killing Perth schoolboy Cassius Turvey in 2022 has failed in an appeal against his sentence. Two men were convicted of murdering the 15-year-old, while Mitchell Forth was convicted of manslaughter and sentenced to 9 years jail. WA's Court of Appeal has found that that was not excessive and his appeal has been dismissed. The Communications Minister says she's having constructive talks with the opposition and the Greens as the government tries to get its gambling reforms through Parliament. Labor's facing a tough fight to get the changes signed off in the Senate after both the Greens and Coalition said they couldn't vote for the legislation in its current form. Communications Minister Annika Wells says the government is not yet considering shelving the bill. Thanks, Belinda. Back with more at 1.
Thank you for that update, Ellie. It is 28 to 1.
You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
Still to come, the Agriculture Minister along shortly with an update on the bird flu situation here in WA, just picking up on a couple of those points that Ali just mentioned. And then Australian Eggs, the national representative body, is saying that vaccines could be a useful option for chicken and egg producers in relation to that H5 bird flu and trying to combat it. Those stories to come here on the Country Hour. And just before one, it's off to Mount Barker for the results of the cattle market. First, though, let's make our way to the Bureau of Meteorology and Bob Tarr with you this afternoon. Bob, let's take a look around northern and eastern parts.
Yeah, sure. So over the north of the state, across the next several days, it's going to be pretty typical conditions across the Kimberley, although we will see some easterly surges developing over southern parts from a new ridge from about Sunday. Across the Pilbara, we have a little bit of a cloud band, especially over western parts of the region that extends into the Gascoyne. We're not going to see a whole lot of rainfall from that, at most just a few mils. In most places, don't see much at all, but it will bring some fairly mild temperatures through the western part of the Pilbara and into the Gascoyne for today and again during Friday, so cool max temperatures. And then a little bit of shower activity over the interior during Friday and maybe more so on Saturday. Cold front is going to bring some showers out through the Gascoyne, especially southern parts, and then out into the goldfields on Saturday, and could see a few mils, especially through southern areas of those regions on Saturday. But the main impact of that cold front is just going to be some colder air pushing through the region. So that's really the story, and then it's just going to be some cold conditions developing from about Sunday or Monday in beneath a new ridge of high pressure.
Let's move into the Southwest Land Division now, Bob, and some cool temperatures and a little bit of rain here and there for some parts anyway. Take us through it.
Yeah, so there is some rain. We're entering a little bit more of an active weather phase with some cold fronts pushing through. Probably still not quite as much rainfall as many people would like, but it's better than nothing, I suppose. So the first cold front is pushing towards the southwest, so showers increasing across that region during this afternoon and evening, and then that'll make its way up through the Perth area. And then that cold front just kind of stagnates across the Perth area, maybe making its way into southern parts of the Midwest and into the western part of the wheat belt. So that's where we're going to see most of the rainfall across the next 24 to 36 hours would be from the southern part of the Midwest down through the southwest corner, and could be at the high end, probably about 15 to 25 mils, especially as you go up into the scarp. Across the western part of the wheat belt, probably not going to see more than a few mils, though, and then amounts really drop off as you go through the Great Southern and the eastern part of the wheat belt. And then in behind that one, a stronger cold front pushes up on Friday night into Saturday. So certainly more cold air behind that. It will be windier, probably not much more in terms of the rainfall. So it's really more of a stronger in terms of the wind it's producing. But yeah, it is going to be a fairly strong front with some pretty cold air in behind it. So we'll see the chance of some small hail in behind the front on Saturday, pushing up as far north is maybe we'll say York, and then into parts of the Great Southern and maybe Salmon Gums as well. So places like that could have some small hail on Saturday, and some inland parts of the Great Southern is probably going to struggle to reach about 10 degrees on Saturday. So it is going to be a cold day on Saturday, even a chance of a little bit of snow across the higher elevation in the Stirlings on that day. So yeah, again, all up, we're not going to see huge rainfalls from this. At the high end over western parts of the Great Southern and the Wheat Belt could see up to about 3 to 10 mils and a little bit of rainfall through the inland part of the Midwest. But a lot of that rainfall is going to be fairly coastal and occurring along the south coast and then the lower west coast and then up into the scarp as well before some of the rain eases or the showers ease on Sunday. Then we have another front on Monday. That one's probably a little bit less certain in terms of the strength of it. So again, it's not going to be a huge rainmaker. If it's a little bit stronger front, we could see several mils pushing up into the wheat belt in the Great Southern. If it's a weaker front, then we're probably only looking at maybe about 1 to 5 mils. So, and then in behind that one, probably looking at a stronger ridge of high pressure developing Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. So not much rainfall on those days. Last thing I'll touch on is just the temperatures. So we are looking at some cold air in behind these fronts, anywhere from about 3 to 5 degrees for a min on Sunday morning across the Midwest. And then wheat belt and Great Southern from about -3 to 2 degrees. Sunday night shouldn't be as cold as with the next cold front pushes in, and then Tuesday and Wednesday mornings looking at some cold air again. So across the Midwest down as low as about 1 or 2 degrees, and then across the wheat belt and the Great Southern anywhere from about -2 to +2 on Tuesday and Wednesday mornings.
And the maximums are pretty chilly too. I mean, was it sort of 10, 11 in some places?
Yeah, especially on Saturday. So I think the next cold front on Monday in behind that one, there's going to be a little bit more sunshine, less in the way of showers. But Saturday is just going to be a pretty crummy day. So just plenty of showers around, a lot of cloud cover. So it's just not going to be able to warm up very much. And the flow is going to be very southwesterly. So, yeah, a lot of places are going to struggle to reach 15, even along the coast and in northern parts. And then, yeah, through inland parts, it'll only be sort of like 9 to 12 degrees on Saturday. So, yeah, people playing like community footy matches and things like that, it's going to be might need the long sleeves.
Sounds like it. Thank you for that, Bob. It is 22 to 1. Richard Hudson is here now to let you know how much rain has fallen across Western Australia.
Yeah, in the last 24 hours, only two regions got any. In the Gascoyne, not much. Coolardy had 4 and Kew had 3. That was it. And then in the southwest, Cape Leeuwin, Capel North and Chapman Hill Road had 5 mils. Kawarrumup 8, Millianup 7, Scott River had 8 and Willyabrup had 6 mils. But the news again today, and it probably will be for a while, seems to be bird flu. And it looks like vaccinations are an option for Australia's commercial egg and chicken producers to combat the deadly H5 bird flu. But not just yet. You'll hear more on that shortly. But first, the WA government is setting up a bird flu wildlife advisory group to help collaboration between representatives from government agencies, conservation groups and vets. And State Agriculture Minister Jackie Jarvis says this is all about trying to minimise the impact of H5 bird flu on the native birds and mammals.
Yeah, look, I mean, and I want to be really clear, and this is sort of a bit of a brutal message, but we will not be able to protect species in the wild. Once wild bird populations are spreading H5 influenza, we will not be able to protect them in the wild. What we can do is make sure these wildlife populations are more resilient. So part of the funding we announced earlier this week for wildlife carers is for them to develop programs that protect at-risk colonies of animals or birds. You know, even things like protecting at-risk colonies from feral cats is really important because we know they can spread the disease. We will obviously work with those at-risk species, but we need to be really well prepared, and that's part of this federal government announcement, is to tell the general public, you know, we're in for a bumpy ride. Our job now is to protect those at-risk colonies, but we will not be able to save every black swan. I just want to be really clear.
So you can't fence them off. Is vaccination a possibility, even if it was just for the black swans or the dolphins in Monkey Maya?
So vaccination only works in captive environments. So the vaccination, I'm told, takes two doses. It can only be done on a small scale. The Commonwealth and the states work together on that. So the Commonwealth also need to test vaccines on different animals. So This virus is new to Australia. We have animal species that occur nowhere else in the world, so obviously we need to make sure the vaccine is safe for those animal species. But I want to be really clear, we cannot vaccinate all the black swans around Lake Munger, for example. Where vaccines play a role...
Would you even try?
You couldn't do it because you need to monitor and do those two doses. Right. So what you might do, though, is you might take a group of animals that are held in a captive environment for their own protection and vaccinate there. So I want to be really clear, there is not going to be a mass vaccination of wildlife.
When you say you could take some, are you saying you could take, I don't know, 20 black swans and protect them for a bit? Is that sort of what you're talking about?
So if animals were at severe risk, you know, little penguins as an example, if they were at severe risk, you could potentially have a group of them in a facility and vaccinate them. But we are talking down the track. We need to see how this virus spreads and we need to see what impact it has. So I guess vaccines are somewhat of a last resort to protect very at-risk vulnerable populations, but it can only work in a captive environment, which is not ideal.
Western Australia's Agriculture Minister Jackie Jarvis speaking to Nadia Mitsopoulos. Well, Rowan McMonies is Managing Director of the national representative body Australian Eggs. He says vaccines could be a useful option to help commercial chicken and egg producers combat H5 bird flu. He was in WA last week chatting to some of those producers, so I asked him if he thought any of them would be vaccinating right now.
Absolutely not. We're not ready for that. There's some significant complexity in relation to HPAI vaccination. I should make it clear they're vaccinating for a range of other production diseases to protect their flock. But for HPAI vaccination, the current policy doesn't really permit, that's government policy, doesn't really permit HPAI vaccination. It is, however, the subject of somewhat of a global movement. It's being explored by a range of other countries, many of which are ahead of us in terms of their HPAI journey. They've had it for a while. They've incurred significant losses. That's made them more interested in assessing HPAI vaccination. There is a good example of in France where they've looked to vaccinate their duck populations and protect them. That's now, it's effectively a big old trial that everyone's able to observe because it's been running for a few years and there's aspects of that everyone's been able to learn from. But we're now seeing other countries, other jurisdictions explore it in earnest. There's trials going on in the UK, the Netherlands, in Italy. And I guess everyone's interested in better ways to manage the level of the virus, which is what vaccination does. And if there's net benefits in doing so, it would make a lot of sense in exploring it. We've been exploring it in Australia, but the reason that the WA producers can't do it is we're not there yet. We're still stepping through some of the issues and the complexity. We, as Australian Eggs, has tried to fuel that process by drawing on research and expertise from overseas and make it available here. But there's policy development processes that have been going on some time. It would be interesting to see whether or not they accelerate in response to the detections that we've seen of HPI in Australia, but I'm not aware of whether they will or not. I am aware, being relatively close to it, that there's some complexity and still some work that needs to be done. Our objective was to do as much of that work as possible before we had a detection and try and get ahead because there's not much point deciding at some stage that you'd like to, but you've got multiple years of issues and work to get through, and through that period you're going to experience delays and losses.
If you have success developing a vaccine specifically for this strain of bird flu and you're able to jump over all the appropriate regulation hurdles, who has to pay for it?
Well, that's completely unresolved. But the first point is to state that, as best I'm aware, that the vaccines for this particular strain exist. You know, they've been developed in other countries by major vaccine suppliers. There's probably debate and even some conjecture about which one is best and what the actual efficacy is, particularly for long-life birds like egg layers. How many times would they actually have to have the vaccine administered in order to be effective across their life?
This sounds COVID all over again.
Well, there's interesting parallels because we're talking about a virus, but it's probably the wrong thing to draw reference to because there's so much conjecture around vaccines during the COVID experience. But in this case, the vaccines are there. There's just other complexities around how it would actually operate. And I think even though it's been suggested that we have discussions around, well, who would pay for what, how could this work, where the government seem to be at the moment is to say, well, we need to define it first. You know, you need to define what we would be doing, and then we could talk about who's going to pay for it. I don't think we have a particular clear policy as an industry around that. But I'm aware from my engagement that there is an openness within industry to pay to some extent if there's an economic benefit in doing so. But another one of the tricks and complexities with vaccination is that there are multiple beneficiaries, including, for example, what we're seeing at the moment is an impact on wildlife. Everybody wants to see that limited because we care about our wildlife. But the question is, well, who pays and who pays to recognise that benefit? I don't think you'll find any particular industry is in a position to, you know, make investments for the public good. You know, that's more of the government space. And that'd be part of the debate when the time comes as to whether or not vaccination's feasible and has net benefits in Australia, how much it will cost and how that cost should be shared.
Is there a sense of inevitability amongst the Western Australian egg producers that bird flu will get into their system?
Yeah, I don't know that there is inevitability it will get into their particular system, but there's a high level of concern because in the broad, that's what it does. It spreads through wildlife. It's happened everywhere else. And because there are opportunities for spillover or crossover between wildlife and commercial poultry, that there is a strong prospect that there will be incursions into commercial farms. There is no suggestion, there should be no suggestion, that it's going to hit every farm. I mean, that hasn't happened anywhere. So it's highly, highly unlikely, possibly a bit silly, to suggest that it's going to hit all of the farms in Australia. And so, and our producers know that. So they're concerned about a risk that they could face an incursion of this particular strain of AI, by no means not a certainty.
So if I could put a scenario to you, let's say bird flu has been detected in a Perth or Fremantle commercial egg producing establishment. Can you just map out what actually happens?
I'll do my best to describe the process. Of course, I'm not the owner of the process. These responses are led, including under legislation, by jurisdictions, so it'd be by the West Australian government, and they've got their processes, and some of these processes will differ slightly state to state. We haven't had a detection in WA of any other form of avian influenza, but we have had experience in the past with H7 avian influenza in other states, and I've been involved with those. But look, to a point, the process is one of trying to remove the virus from the farm so that the farm can go back to a commercial operation, including interacting with the world, taking in inputs and producing eggs and distributing them without creating risks to others that it's engaging with. So unfortunately for a farm that's impacted, production stops depending on the circumstances, but most likely the birds need to be depopulated. That's both on a disease risk perspective, also a welfare perspective. The birds are suffering as the virus moves through the flock, and so they must be euthanized and they must be removed from the property. It's important to note in stating that is a process that nobody wants, but it's an unfortunate aspect, a necessary aspect of seeking to protect the broader flock of commercial poultry and also wildlife as well.
So does that mean every chicken on that property would be killed?
It doesn't necessarily mean. It's a risk-based assessment that the authorities conduct. If you have chickens that are, you know, very close, you know, the shed next door, etc., and they're sharing infrastructure, then in those circumstances, those, you know, both sheds would need to go, even if it hasn't been detected in those birds. You otherwise look at the distance, the separation, etc., and it may be possible to contain it to one part of the farming operation and not the other. You can only imagine that the objective of those epidemiologists that make those assessments is to contain it as much as possible and protect as much as possible and limit the loss and the impact.
Australian Eggs Managing Director Rowan McMonies. And in case you're wondering, in such a scenario where birds do test positive to bird flu in a commercial setup, Rowan was saying the producers would be compensated under Australia's Emergency Animal Disease Response Agreement, but it would only be for the assets lost, in other words, for the chooks themselves. The compensation at this stage doesn't cover anything else, including the future loss of income from a lack of egg production.
Richard, what are the latest bird flu figures?
Yeah, there's some more positives, unfortunately. CSIRO testing has confirmed another 16 positive bird flu detections in Victoria. So 14 greater crested terns, a silver gull and a magpie, and all of these birds were found in the vicinity of Portland and Nelson. There have also been 6 further confirmed positive detections in South Australia, all in greater crested terns. So there have now been 123 confirmed or presumed positive detections of H5 bird flu in Australia. That's based on the sample testing. Still just 10 confirmed cases in WA, and it's been roughly 14 days, according to Jackie Jarvis, since the last positive confirmation. And the Federal Department of Agriculture is still saying no detections in poultry or in our agricultural production system, and the risk to human health still remains low.
Thanks for that, Richard. 8 minutes to one.
The Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
We'll get to the results of the Mount Barker cattle market shortly. First, though, livestock agencies are busy pulling data together to prove that Australian lamb exports aren't harming America's sheep industry. Now, this follows last month's announcement that the US International Trade Commission will launch a global safeguard investigation into lamb imports. Larissa Smith has the story.
Australia sends more than $1 billion worth of lamb to the US every year. It's a high-value market. The American Sheep Industry Association has a beef with this, arguing imports have been undermining domestic production. Red meat analyst Simon Quilty disagrees.
Today in America, lamb, domestic lamb, is at record prices, never before seen. It's the equivalent of $19.50 Australian per kilo. And our own lamb is trading at $11.50. So there's a 70% difference in price. So has the US industry been harmed on today's data? Not at all.
But historically?
So the year that they're worried about is 2024. That's the period in which they claim that pricing of Australian lamb was 19% at times discounted to US, and it was harmful. Okay, let's call BS on that as well, because in that year, domestic lamb in America rose 12.5%. So if Australia was so harmful, then why did US domestic prices rise that year? It wasn't harmful, is the clear message. If logic prevailed, I think it's a very thin argument they have. But we know that there is now a political desire to raise revenue by using tariffs in America.
Australian lamb exports to the US now attract a 12.5% tariff. There are concerns that figure could jump to 30% as a result of the current safeguard investigation. Michael Crowley is Meat and Livestock Australia's Managing Director.
This will need to have engagement at the highest levels of government, because it would be a very high level decision that is made, and the President would need to make that decision. So, and we've seen how tariffs have been used to influence trade over the last couple of years, and it has been really disruptive. However, we just see such strong demand and future growth in the category We also recognise that the US lamb prices are at record levels. Their production is under pressure. We're really keen to see long-term growth of the category, and then there's enough room for us all to play. We see it as being really unnecessary. So we're working with industry. The Australian Meat Industry Council are the representative body for the processing sector and exporters. We're working very closely with them. We're collating a lot of information on data and insights to support the industry representatives as well as our government representatives to be in a really strong position through this safeguard investigation, because we see the downside risk could be highly significant.
So the question is, can the lamb sector here wear a tariff more than double the current rate?
So initially, we could see prices passed forward 15 to 20% of the 30, but as supply comes on, more and more will be passed back to this end. So to answer your question, timing is everything. I would say initially, the blow is softened, but as we move forward into 28, 29, 30, as supply picks up, it gets harder to pass it forward and it's borne more by the producer.
Is consumption of lamb in the US growing?
It's been exceptional. Even though they only make up, you know, I think it's close to 1.7%, we've seen exceptional growth, but also exceptional pricing. Today, lamb is worth three times that of chicken and pork in America.
That's a bit hard to fathom.
It is. So it's trading at near on $9.50 a pound versus pork and chicken at $3 to $3.50 a pound in America. So US dollars per pound. So I coin it the new Wagyu because it truly is an elite product. We've seen in the last few months that there is now a little bit of consumer pushback, and there's no doubt that some of the volume increases we saw have started to slow down. Do I think that means we're going to see prices fall in America? No. I think there's more rationalization because tighter supplies will occur next year. Fewer people will be able to afford it, but prices remain steady, if not higher, into next year. Just fewer people will be eating it.
Simon Quilty from AgriTrends ending that report. 3 minutes to one. Now, if you're interested in fruit production, tune in tomorrow because we're going to have a special feature on narrow orchard systems that are being trialled in WA's southwest.
Yes, number one advantage is driving production per hectare, and we've seen average industry production go from about 25 tonne to the hectare back in 2006 to where we're now averaging just over 40 tonne to the hectare as an industry, but the top quartile of industry is now producing over 80 tonne to the hectare.
And this sort of trial is looking at taking it ahead even further?
Yes, very definitely, and taking it ahead even further, but at the same time reducing production costs and maybe trying to also reduce asset costs in terms of the initial planting cost as well.
More from Nanup fruit producer Mark Scott on tomorrow's Country Hour. 2 minutes to one to the markets, and at the Mount Barker sale yards this morning, cattle numbers were down 274 on the previous sale 2 weeks ago. The final tally, 859. Tracy Kilner has the prices for you.
A mixed quality yarding with weights down on last sale and prices reflecting. A good yarding of yearling cattle saw steers gain with feeder demand while the heifers eased on quality. Heavy slaughtered cattle eased with processor demand, seeing heavy heifers, cows and bulls down 15 to 30 cents this week. The weaner steers weighing over 280 kilos sold at 498 to 582 cents. Lightweight sold from 480 to 634 cents a kilo. Weaner heifers weighing over 330 kilos made from 440 to 484. Weights over 280 kilos sold from 456 to 500 cents. And the lightweights made from 430 to 484 cents a kilo. Yearling steers gained with feeder demand, selling from 460 to 560 cents quality dependent. Yearling heifers eased, returning 430 up to 498 cents a kilo. The grown heifers eased with weights under 540 kilos, making 360 to 402 cents, and heavier weights returned 328 to 406 cents a kilo. Heavyweight cows sold from 300 to 340 cents, medium weights made from 300 to 328 cents, Heavy bulls sold from 250 to 328 cents, and another large yarding of lightweight bullies returned 322 to 440 cents a kilo. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you, Tracy. A couple of texts to finish off. As if vaccine deniers will eat chooks full of vaccines, wait until consumers find out all the meat we eat is vaccinated, drenched and backlined. And this from Chris. I reckon the eagles have had bird flu for the last 5 years. Thank you for that, Chris. On the ABC, it is news time, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.